Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Garden Cult, garden design and coaching. For a 15% discount on virtual garden consultations and coaching sessions, use code HRN15. Learn more at gardencult.com.
Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network. Out of control greenhouse gas emissions exacerbate climate change. We've known this connection to be true for some time, and the Biden administration's recommitment to environmental advocacy and conservation work has helped remind us of the urgent need to understand and combat climate change. Today, we're going to dive deeper into the understanding part. Who are the people doing the on-the-ground work? We keep hearing calls to trust the science, but what methods and studies does the science entail? We're grateful to have Francesco Tubieto speaking with us today about the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's most recent report that clearly demonstrates food systems account for more than one-third of global greenhouse gas emissions and provides critical guidance for holistic mitigation efforts. Francesco, welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you very much.
So first, can you give us a brief overview of the history and mission of FAO? Does it solely focus on global food insecurity?
Well, it does focus on a wide range of things that relate to food and agriculture in general. So FAO, as many may know or not, is the specialized UN agency for food and agriculture. It was funded right after World War II, there were huge problems, larger than today, about food security around the world, with a mission to increase understanding of, novel techniques that countries could adopt to produce more food for the rest of the world. And of course, from then on, so the initial focus was largely on agricultural production, but then it expanded to, the entire range of production and distribution and inequalities and poverties and all the various, dynamics that relate to food and nutrition.
And you work across the entire global community, all countries are involved in this work?
Yeah, we have... Basically, all countries in the world are members of FAO. We have some 194 countries and one associate and one organization, which is actually the EU, so 196 in total. And yeah, I mean, depending on the kind of projects that you work, you end up either through big regional workshops or bilateral talks and interactions to work with many countries around the world.
And tell me about yourself. How long have you worked at FAO, and what is your role there?
Well, I've been at FAO almost 10 years, and I am a so-called senior statistician there. I basically head the group that produces environmental statistics that relate to food and agriculture. Those are basically the data that are then disseminated in FAO-STAT for the your listeners that know about FAO-STAT. It's basically one of the largest repositories of food and agricultural data around the world. So that's what I do. We good part of my work is collecting data from countries and analyzing them and then disseminate them at the end of the year and then use those data to release and do a whole bunch of analysis that revolve on various aspects of environmental impacts, for example, or input use. That's about it. I mean, I have a larger career before joining FAO in academia. I was actually in the US working on climate change and impacts and issues related to agriculture. And that's, I guess, how it got me close to them working at FAO.
And how does your work intersect with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, whose reports mm-hmm. we have covered in the past on the show, for example, or other departments within the UN? Do you collaborate? I'm assuming.
Yeah, no, in many ways. So, well, first of all, there is a you know, loosely called climate change unit in FAO that, let's say, has the primary mandate to interact with IPCC. Mm-hmm. Personally, I've actually been a lead author of several reports, starting, I guess, from AR4 back in 2007. Mm-hmm. And always working, well, initially, you know, in my previous role as a scientist working in the area, but then also from within FAO. So, for example, we provide now data on greenhouse gas emissions to the IPCC reports, among other agencies that then provide, you know, independent type of data to do a proper synthesis. Yeah, so, you know, we also interact with developing guidelines that countries follow to report their emissions to the Climate Convention. And, you know, in general, a whole set of issues that revolve around food. I mean, there was a special report in 2019 on land and climate change, which, of course, included agriculture as a big core mm-hmm. of that report. Yeah, so let's say largely we interact at a scientific technical level with IPCC.
Okay. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the, you know, the repercussions of greenhouse gas emissions on a warming planet. Sort of do a bit of a primer. So can you kind of remind us, for those who aren't steeped in the science every single day, the connection between greenhouse gas emissions mm-hmm. and climate change? And tell us a little bit about what greenhouse gases are maybe more potent that perhaps we should be focusing on reducing first.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's
I know it's a very broad subject.
But to be concise, for those who might be know less about this. So, I mean, we you know, there is a concentration of gases in the atmosphere naturally there that keep the Earth warmer than it would otherwise be, and that's why we call it the greenhouse effect, right? It works more or less the same way the glass keeps warmth within a greenhouse. And, you know, there are a number of gases that are important, but there is a triad, let's say, of so-called trace gases, and primarily is CO2, right, carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxides, which are also produced in large amounts by human activities, right? So whereas there is a, let's say, an equilibrium level that has existed, you know, since the beginning for many years, for hundreds of thousands of years, since the beginning of our, you know, very large industrial activities and growth as in terms of population numbers and on as you know, as increased in the atmosphere. Significantly so, especially over the last 100 years. So just to provide, you know, a context, I mean, the CO2 levels in the atmosphere today are about 400, and in fact these days are over 420 parts per million, which is very small, right? It's like it would correspond to something like 0.04% in terms of concentrations in the atmosphere, you know, whereas oxygen is 21%, but they trap heat very effectively. And so those levels of 420 parts per million, you know, at equilibrium, we're more like 280, 300. So we're up about 40% with respect to the natural level. And and that delta translates into, you know, more heat that it's trapped by our planet, and then translates in temperature increases.
And then, I mean, that CO2 is not necessarily, or is it, the most potent? I mean, compared to something like methane or fluorinated greenhouse gases, which I read about for the first time in your report.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, Yes and no. I mean, certainly, you know, there is a concept that we call the global warming potential, you know, where we compare different gases to the impacts of CO2. Mm-hmm. So if you take CO2 to have an impact of one in terms of its, you know, its effect on warming the planet, then, you know, depending on how you measure it, but let's say, you know, ballpark, methane is about 30 times more potent. So 1 ton of methane emitted in the atmosphere would end up warming the planet about 30 times more than the same amount emitted in CO2. Nitrous oxides, you know, almost 300 times. And then you get into the fluorinated gases that can have, you know, thousands of times more impact. Now, the catch is, of course, that the emissions in absolute amounts are far bigger in CO2, but that doesn't really do away with the problem, especially, you know, over the last century, let's say the amount of warming that we've created other than CO2 is now about a third of the total in terms of the other non-CO2 gases.
Okay.
So it's important.
Bad. Right? So that's a problem.
Yeah.
And what are the global effects of a warming planet? Like, why does FAO dedicate time to studying this issue, given its mission and focus on global food insecurity, for instance, within a growing population?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the straight answer is that agriculture is, you know, perhaps among the various human activities, the one that most depends on external climate, right? At least it has so far in the last 8,000 years of agricultural production and civilization. So, you know, a changing planet with a warming planet on the one hand, and, you know, much increased frequency of extreme events, which is what is projected by the models, but increasingly what we see on our daily lives, unfortunately, you know, that poses risks of increased crop failure, you know, not necessarily on a, you know, larger, you know, on a large scale, but, you know, in places where it might become fundamental to, you know, where you might want to instead increase production because of development patterns. And so it's clearly a problem, right? So we talk, for example, about adaptation when we talk about, you know, climate change impacts, which means trying to figure out within a basket of possibilities what are the kind of things that can be done to minimize those risks that we know are coming.
To me, it seems like there is a lot of concern about our collective international ability to feed a growing planet, yet not nearly enough attention to mitigating the effects of climate change in order to do so. Do you agree that there's this disconnect? And if so, why do you think that is?
You mean in relation to agriculture?
Yes.
Couple of things, you know. First of all, obviously, as you said, I mean, the agriculture is at the basis of our entire civilization, right? We need to eat to stay alive and produce and progress. So the main focus historically has always been on production and on techniques to either maximize the production or limit, you know, potential dangers that come from that. You know, that come from climate change to that production. Now, then a couple of things, right? I mean, certainly also historically, the emissions of fossil fuels, you know, are used for energy have been far larger, let's say, if you look at the last 50 years, than anything that had come from agriculture. Except, like you mentioned before, once you start thinking of, CO2 is also important, but non-CO2 gases, methane, nitrous oxides, which instead agriculture is a primary producer, then that attention has increasingly shifted, right, to arrive more or less to the kind of work that we're producing today, where we are trying to point out areas where agriculture can play a role in mitigating climate change. If I may add, I mean, there's always been a pull, right, between the right and the need for people to produce enough food to survive and beyond, right? So food security concerns versus things that should change to then limit those impacts onto climate. And I think that sort of pull and has not been only limited to agriculture. I mean, historically, you might have heard of, people discussing problems with employment, let's say, right? If certain industries that produce CO2 would have to curtail their production. So although you need to do both, it's also understandable why people have this sort of fight in how to best address it.
Do you think, have you seen a shift over the course of your career in the recognition that people give to food and ag's contribution to climate change?
Well, certainly. I mean, when I started, no one really, although it's a well-known fact that agriculture was a big emitter. If you think historically, even before the Industrial Revolution, agriculture was actually the primary emitter of CO2 into the atmosphere through conversion of land use for agriculture. But agriculture per se never played an important role earlier on in mitigation. I would say over the last 15 years, it started to gain momentum when people, pointed out that many of the things that you would do to make agriculture, let's say, more resilient to the impacts of climate change, they realized that many of those things would also bring about, better ecosystems functions, which means more carbon sequestered into the soil and so on and so forth. Then that provided sort of impetus for looking at the two things together. And I think that's still what, especially from institutions like FAO, what you would want. You want to investigate solutions that do both, right? And don't put at risk food security just for the sake of reducing the emissions, as mm-hmm. important as that may be.
Right. Okay, so let's transition into the recently released study that you co-authored in collaboration with the European Commission's Joint Research Center. How was this study conducted, and what is new or different about the work that you did?
Well, a couple of things. So like I said before, including especially from FAO, right? So we had spent the last... I would say a decade or so in trying to, increasingly better quantify the emissions from agriculture first. So mm-hmm. when I say agriculture, I mean mainly crop and livestock production, although, agriculture includes, at least from an FAO perspective, also forestry production and fisheries, right? But mm-hmm. but let's think about, let's say, the farm gate production and the emissions that come from that side. So we did that, and then we spent a lot of time also in trying to quantify the so those emissions are mostly non-CO2, so methane from livestock largely, and then nitrous oxides from fertilizers used and the like. Then we spent a lot of time adding the CO2 emissions, so the carbon that comes from the destruction of ecosystems turned into agriculture, and that's mostly deforestation around the world. So there's a lot of work that's been spent, let's say within the farm gate and at the boundaries between farm gate and natural ecosystems. And that, over time has brought, this message that I think is sort of synced in, that agriculture and land use are a very important component on, the whole emission pie, up to a quarter. Then over time they become more like, let's say, between 20% and 25%. So we were at that stage. And then just recently, and especially this year, you may know that, you will certainly know, there is an important UN summit on food and on food systems in particular. Mm-hmm. So the attention started to shift to that question. Once you characterize the emissions within farm gate and on land, how much more does food contribute once you start thinking about everything that's associated to food, after it's been produced, from processing to manufacturing to, the whole supply chain and consumption. And so there had been a lot of studies on that, but they were very generic. So they came up with global numbers on trying to figure out what the contribution could be. So we had some idea. But the novelty of this study, and to get back to your question, is that no one had actually been able to quantify it, you know, in a, through a database. Database means you have information for all the countries in the world over, let's say, sufficiently long time period, in this case, 1992, more or less present. And so the novelty of the study has been, more than the adding the science of what that global contribution is, you know, the provision of a tool that then everybody can use to look what happens in their country and compare that to other countries around the world.
And sorry, I just want to confirm. So 25% of emissions of greenhouse gases are from land use, agricultural land use. That's the starting point.
Yeah, actually, today it's more like 20%, right? Because these emissions tend, you know, in relative terms, tend to go down over time, and we can discuss in the course of the interview why that is so. Let's say today, more or less, 20% of those emissions come from the land use and the farm.
Land use and the farm. Okay, and so what the study does was really take a broader view to incorporate.
That's right.
Yeah, the other aspects throughout the supply chain that contribute. Okay, so let's talk about some of the key findings of your report. What were some of the top takeaways in terms of top emitters by country, emission breakdown by sectors within the food industry and throughout the supply chain?
Yeah. Well, so I mean, the takeaway message that comes from the paper is. Firming up of the number of the total contribution of food systems, as the entire concept on the pie of total anthropogenic emissions on the planet. And as you've seen in the paper, so we say now about a third, right? A little bit more than a third, 33-34% in 2015, which is the last year that was where we were able to make firm estimates, right? So basically what that says is that additional component, beyond food production and the farm gate, so we said about 20%. So there's another 10-15% of additional emissions, which had not been previously quantified. Not that we didn't know about it, but we weren't able to quantify them so specifically. That's, let's say, a global level, right? The global level results. Then the other part that I think it's important that comes out of the paper is the different interplay that these emissions have in different parts of the world, depending on development status, right? And in a sense, some of these things, exposed, I wouldn't say are obvious, but they sort of self-explain themselves once you think about them. So, and again, just put in your... In your mind, the fact that in addition, this gets quantified country by country, and then in a sense is the added value of the paper. But basically, what comes out is a confirmation that as countries sit, let's say, in a more traditional and therefore less developed overall economic situation, the majority of the emissions that come from the food systems are basically due to land conversions. Right, so the deforestation that happens around the world, and another important phenomena, for example, in certain parts of the world, people drain their natural peatlands and burn them to make space for certain plantations, and that is a huge emitter of CO2. And then as you move over the development, and this is something that you might also be known in terms of development paths, but was never quantified. As you move along your development path, you start solving your let's say natural ecosystem problem, right? Because you don't convert, you learn how to use your land more efficiently, less deforestation, less destruction of natural ecosystems. But then as you develop your systems more effectively, quote unquote, right, then you start spending a lot more energy in processing food, right? To create higher, higher value from various food items. And therefore, in that category of countries, then you get a lot more CO2 emissions from the second part, let's say, of the emission chain that we referred to. So the processing, the supply chains, the consumption, right? And the mm-hmm. and the waste, let's say. I think these are the main point. The other interesting outcomes is that because now you have a database rather than just talking about regional and global trends, you can actually look at it in individual countries and the weight that they have in these emissions. And I think the interesting part of this paper is that if you look at the top countries, and I'm not sure I want to name them all, but there is now a mix. You can see in this list there is a mix of both developing countries and developed ones for the interplay of what I just said, right? Mm-hmm. So countries in Southeast Asia, like in Indonesia, come up on top because basically they're still very heavy in that phase of conversion of natural ecosystems to establish mm-hmm. Food production, some of which is actually for export, by the way, so there are additional problems there that could be invested.
Certainly, yeah.
And then there are other countries which are basically, don't necessarily have a history even of big conversions, if not, thousands of years ago, but, so China, for example, comes in as an important emitter because of the strong development path that it has had over the last, 10, 20 years, which basically has added that the CO2 component as a weight in its own emissions, apart from being a big country, of course, mm-hmm. and therefore having a lot of livestock and so on and so forth.
Are they a big producer as well? Mm-hmm. is like, in terms of the, so we can just, go ahead and I could list them according to some of what I read. The top emitters: China, Indonesia, the United States, Brazil, the EU,
right.
and India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you see, exactly, it's this interesting mix of developing and developed countries, which you don't see if you only looked at, let's say, agriculture plus land use, where in fact right. only developing countries come up on top because of that, strong yeah. conversion component. Yeah.
They're all
big producers of different things, right? So China, of course, is a big producer by the fact that it has a very large population and a large area, and same thing for Indonesia and Brazil. There, although the reason for the large emissions there is mostly for the land conversion, so deforestation in Brazil and a lot of peatland. Drainage and fires in Indonesia, of which, of course, we're not discovering anything here through this study. I mean, the New York Times last year ran a whole series of stories on the smoke that comes out in that part of the world from simply the drainage and burning of peatland.
Mm-hmm.
So
I was wondering why Indonesia was on top, because I feel like we hear about the U.S. and China.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps India,
yeah.
Often in terms of top emitters, but mm-hmm. I was wondering about Indonesia and Brazil just seems to me maybe like, I mean, is Brazil considered still a developing country?
In terms of how, UN, World Bank and OECD sort of divide up the world, which, in part is only for convenience, but certainly... So what we speak about are, of course, we speak of emerging economies, with mm-hmm. very strong development pathways and accelerated ones. So, what makes these countries emit very strongly at the moment is still a dynamic that is strongly pointing to development. Right, so the very
right.
strong land use conversion that is there. Now, also to point out for your listeners, because this is not something that is necessarily obvious to the paper, is we follow a so-called territorial approach, because we're trying to mimic how countries would report their emissions to the climate convention, also to be relevant to that process. And so some of the emissions that you see that are allocated here to certain countries, they are allocated to those countries because the production and the, say, quote-unquote, associated destruction is located in those countries. That doesn't mean that, you know, the embedded emissions in products such as soybean, let's say, right, or palm oil, those products are often exported to richer countries, right? Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't see that on this list.
So you're attributing kind of where they end up, or where they...
We're attributing where they are generated.
Generated.
Yeah.
And do you do any comparison between the effects of let's say more deforestation and conversion of land use compared to other sort of further developed countries whose emissions come from more of an industrialized, you know, standpoint? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a way to kind of compare those two to see which ones emit the most, which ones are worse, mm-hmm. if you will? Or is that just like a false comparison?
No, it's not a false. I mean, it's obviously, I mean, I deal with data all the time. So comparisons are always tricky, right? Because you can make a lot of comparisons and right. on things that sound, you know, cool and interesting. And sometimes, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be explained behind it to really come up with something that is useful in the end for action, let's say. But in this case, I mean, we do have the information because, you know, we track the processes separately, right? So we do know how much was emitted, let's say, on the farm versus on the land conversion component versus everything that came afterwards. Mentally, you can think of the three as, you know, a mix of the three, in a sense, defines... in general, right, there are exceptions, but defines the development level of a country, right? Mm-hmm. So as we said before, I mean, a lot of countries, and now we're not talking about the Brazils of the world or the Indonesians, but maybe a lot of smaller countries in you know, truly developed, you know, early development stages, you know, have most of their emissions that come not even from the farm, but let's say from the land use conversion, right? It's sort of the beginning of that development path. But of course, you know, when you then compare the impacts of those on the global, you know, numbers, that's very small. That doesn't mean, you know, but what comes up of interest there is it's this current process with the climate conversion, with the climate process, right? The framework convention, where every country is supposed to contribute some mitigation, you know, as in relation to their national emissions. And in many of these countries, there's not a lot of emission apart from these ones. Mm-hmm. So even if they're small, they are, you know, in a sense, that's the only place where they can look for mitigating their emissions, right? Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing is, if I may, but you know, please,
of course,
keep me within the bounds of my
no, please.
Of my discourse. Is one of the things that comes out of this paper. Again, once you think about it, ex post, it's obvious, but it's not. You know, it wasn't obvious in the numbers that we had before. So we used to think that, you know, once you solve the development problem, let's say, right, and so you arrived at a sustainable agricultural production within the farm, and therefore you've solved all your land use problems, land use change problems, then things would be fine. But in fact, what this paper highlights very strongly is that, of course, that's, you know, everybody wants that, and it's a great goal in its own right to stop deforestation, stop peatland degradations and other ecosystems. But then, you know, what this paper points out is after you do that, you still have the big problems with the energy use on the post-production process. And so it's basically highlighting that, you know, both sets of countries have mitigation obligations. They just sit in different parts of the economy or let's say in different parts of the objectives and how mm-hmm. to reach them. On one side, you know, we're talking about proper management of ecosystems. On the other is, you know, mitigation by looking at things such as shifting from use of fossil fuels into renewables when it's, you know, you can't avoid using energy to process things. And I'm sure we'll get into this part of the interview by, you know, reducing waste and mm-hmm. all sorts of things.
So in terms of like your overall results, top line, that headlines, mm-hmm. you found that global per capita annual food related emissions have declined over mm-hmm. the period that you studied. Is this correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's another important outcome of the paper because, it's better than what's actually going on with global greenhouse gas emissions per capita, right? Because those are, you know, things tend to come down over time by matter of economies of scales, you know, increased efficiencies in every sector of the economy. But if you look at greenhouse gas emissions globally, you know, I think over the last 20 years or so, they've basically stayed fairly constant, right? Whereas to see this trend in the food system component, while, you know, also noting that food systems contribute about a third to the total is encouraging. Now, if you really want to look behind, you know, under the hood and see why this is going on at the moment, mm-hmm. I mean, the main driver of this is the reduced rates of, it's the land use. So it's, you know, we've seen over the last 15 years, 20 years maybe, but especially in the last 10, 5, you know, big decreases in deforestation rates. And although they're still important, you know, and they deserve attention until they go to near zero, those have come down significantly. So those economies that you mentioned before, which are basically strongly emerging economies, are, at least moving away from the very high rates that were present around the year 2000 or so. So that's what's driving.
But is this because they already developed the land, like, you know, well, it's in the past? Or are the rates really slowing down the rates at which this conversion is happening?
Well, it's a continuous battle that we cannot abandon. But let's say in countries like Brazil, despite reports of deforestation rates having picked up again over the last few years, there has been, you know, very significant efforts, you know, including, you know, at the national regulation levels that have tried to keep, you know, to reduce rates, to encourage people to conserve land, to, you know, provide incentives of different kinds, monetary, but also assistance mm-hmm. in trying to slow that down, including, of course, then international agreements, right? I mean, the Climate Convention and the agreement for trying to reach Paris heavily depend on what countries do in terms of their land conversion. So there are incentives that are being built, including, you know, monetary ones through carbon credits or, you know, similar systems where countries pay attention and try to put some regulations in place.
Mm-hmm. So at the same, I mean, are you worried that this little bit of good climate change related news could lead to a kind of relaxing of certain standards, taking our foot off the gas, so to speak?
Not really, because the task that we have ahead, and we're talking, you know, we've set for ourselves multiple goals, but, you know, one of the main one, both for the sustainable development and for the climate change, is 2030. And unfortunately, you know, the time is, you know, clock is ticking, and it's now less than 9 years away. Mm-hmm. The scale of what we need to do is so huge, and we're going to be reminding ourselves through, you know, multiple processes. You know, we have a monitoring, international monitoring efforts in place, which, you know, regularly will remind the world of where we are. And now, you know, so from that perspective, I'm not worried, because the messages that will come out repeatedly out of those exercises, that we're not doing nearly enough. Right. And so that will serve as a reminder that, you know, there's almost nowhere where we could
relax.
So, yeah, right. Yeah, but as you said, I mean, there is, you know, we're writing other, you know, current papers on and the follow-up of this. There is a little bit of danger that, you know, especially the story on land use, that it's becoming, let's say, quote-unquote, better, right? Because there are these major countries that are reducing their emissions. There is a little bit of danger that people sort of take their attention away, maybe move it towards, you know, supply chains and the more developed sort of processes. And so our task, of course, is to try to keep the message alive that mm-hmm. mitigation needs to happen across all, you know, all the range of food systems.
Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors, but we will be right back, so stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Garden Cult, garden design and coaching. Carmen DeVito is a professional garden designer, certified New York State landscape professional, and the founder of Garden Cult. You may also know her from HRN's home gardening videos and our series, We Dig Plants. Garden Cult is a culmination of Carmen's more than two decades of experience designing and building gardens in New York City. Carmen believes that gardens and outdoor spaces should be healthy, environmentally sustainable places that enhance the health of people, nature, and the planet. She knows how to help you maximize the space you've got, help you work with and make the most of the materials, plants, and trees that you already have, and create an outdoor place to use and enjoy for you and your family. Get started at gardencult.com. For a 15% discount on virtual garden consultations and coaching sessions, use code HRN15 through September 30th, 2021. That's code HRN15 at gardencult.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Francesco Dubiero from the FAO about the recent report demonstrating that food systems worldwide account for more than a third of global greenhouse gas emissions.
The report highlights also how global food systems are becoming more energy intensive, right? Which reflects the, would you say that's the downstream effects?
Sure.
What can really be done around things like refrigeration, right? I think mm-hmm. that comes up in the report quite a bit.
Yeah.
This is still lacking in developing countries, and that leads to other big problems like food waste and, mm-hmm. you know, poor quality. So what are some recommended interventions, or do you have any, to address this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue here is, I mean, there is, of course, a range of interventions. The issue is that, there's both a positive and a negative in looking at food systems as a whole system, right? Mm-hmm. The positive is that it highlights, you know, the problem from within a theme that it's important, which is food, right? You know, so we quantify that it's a third of the emissions. We quantify these dynamics that we just discussed. And they're all important in the sense that they serve, you know, to focus the public's attention to this issue. Mm-hmm. The downside is that the food system, I mean, it's, you know, once you look at its components, it's a range of heterogeneous parts, right? Because we discussed ourselves about production on the farm, right? Which has, mm-hmm. you know, and so you can do a lot of things there, but basically have to do with agronomy, basically, you know, improve crop and livestock production. There is that component on ecosystem that is its own set. And then when you look at the post-processing, of course, you have some of the things you mentioned, so refrigeration because of the chlorofluorocarbons that are involved in refrigeration, but then there is the waste issue, there is how you produce let's say inputs to so it's an industry component. So let's say setting it, so it's complex, right?
Yes.
But there are, yeah, so the two things that you mentioned are important, and I don't think they're necessarily just an issue of developing countries, because as I said, I mean, these are things that kick in very strongly along the development pathway, right? And especially once you get, you know, your economy going, you know, you're starting to use things that everyone uses, and so the challenge there is in part technology transfer, right? So the countries that are more advanced, you know, the USAs, the Europeans and others that are in part already dealing with this through, you know, the development of more efficient machinery, let's say, in a sense, have an opportunity to make sure that when the new countries come on the block, right?
Yeah.
They basically have access to, you know, the most efficient production techniques, right? And there are actually, you know, in the Climate Convention, there are a lot of provisions for this. I mean, you know, of course, the devil is in the detail. How do you actually make it happen? But let's say that's one of the pathways. Let's say, you know, technology transfer and assistance in aiding countries that come into, you know, the developed group, and, you know, not to repeat the same mistakes that we've been, you know, that we made over the last 30 to 40 to 50 years, right?
Yeah.
So that's one area. I mean, waste is, of course, a very important one. I mean,
yes.
from two components, you know, so food waste is, you know, we talk about food loss and waste, but both are important. And they are important for a number of reasons. That's an area where we can bring back that link between, you know, food security and mitigation and sort of one unified problem that has many positive angles, right? Mm-hmm. Because food waste, let's say, from a mitigation component, is a problem because, you know, you start emitting unnecessarily greenhouse gases that you didn't have to if you had used that food more efficiently, on the one hand. Some of the quantification that we made in the paper actually have to do with the methane that comes out of landfills, where most of the organic waste ends up. But then on the opposite side, if you, you know, forget for a second about the emissions and the mitigation needs, there is sort of almost a moral imperative, right, of making the most out of the food that we produce today. I mean, it's been noted in you know, many times that we actually make enough food, produce enough food for everyone on the planet.
And yet, we already do. Yeah.
Right? We waste and lose and waste about 30% of it. And so that 30% translates both in primarily, I would say, in terms of food security solutions, right? If you were able to distribute that more efficiently, we'd be basically there. And at the same time, I would say at this point, I would look at more as a byproduct, right? Like, you know, as opposed to the main driver on why to do this, you would end up then, you know, having less waste and therefore having, you know, wasting, you know, emitting less greenhouse gases. Yeah.
But food waste wasn't really, did you really look at that?
So yes and no. I mean, let's say the answer is yes, but it's tricky, right? Because, let's say from a technical perspective, in terms of computation, what is, you know, what contributes to the emissions that are quantified in the paper is the what we call the food waste disposal, right? So the food that is discarded or it's wasted in supermarkets or in the house, and that gets thrown out and then eventually disposed of if it's not composted, you know, it ends up in the landfill, and there, you know, it rots and emits methane, basically, right? So in a sense, when you look at the food systems as this, you know, whole concept, that those get counted. But usually, you know, what people Most likely your listeners think of when they think of food waste is what we discussed before, right? The amount that it's wasted before it's fed to people. So that part...
Pre-consumer,
that,
yeah.
Yeah. So that part is implicitly included in the... Well, implicitly and explicitly, but it's included in the paper, you know, insofar we cover the entire production chain, right? Mm-hmm. So we cover production before it gets lost or wasted. So those emissions, you know, are accounted for, but they are not singled out.
They're not teased out. What about the role of packaging? When you talk about its impact, is that primarily around the fossil fuels that are used to create the plastic packaging, or what do you mean by that in the report?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was, I think, another, you know, maybe in the larger scheme of things, a small component, but important because it was, I think, the first time that was quantified in such details and by country as well as globally. So one of the things that came out is that the emissions from packaging are basically comparable to the ones from food transport. Which is not, well, you know, again, you know, some of these things, when you think about them ex post, might become more or less obvious if you think about it. But the point of the paper is it actually quantified in numbers. So there's right. not much of a discussion. So, yeah, I mean, the emissions that come from packages are mostly linked to the industrial production, right, of plastics mostly. And so that sort of processing and the energy that it spent in producing them, right? There is a small component in terms of organic packaging because that has some impact on forest dynamics, but that was a minor component in the calculations.
And by organic, do you mean like compostable packaging?
Yeah. Sorry, I meant pulp and paper, right? Production.
Okay. Interesting. Well, we have to wrap up in just a minute, but I want to, how can we make better use of the data that you're collating? Like how, you know, when you're doing this study, how do you hope it will be used?
Well, the hope, of course, is that it's as useful as possible. One of the reasons we put out these products, especially from an FAO perspective, but of course, the European Union has sort of the same approach in this, right? We tend to produce things that we think as public goods, right? So first of all, the database is there, it's free to use, everybody can access the data, and because, you know, it has this granularity, so it compare, you know, you're able to compare one country to another. I mean, one of the hopes is that it can be used, especially you know, within regions, by countries, to sort of, first of all, you know, analyze, you know, where they are compared to, you know, global and regional, sub-regional averages, make, you know, a more detailed analysis of which of these three components that we discussed before, you know, have this important interplay are most important, and then use the information to set out their mitigation strategies, you know, for, well, in this case, you know, the major process in town here is the climate convention, but also for sustainable development goals, right? We find often, I mean, from an FAO perspective, I mean, one thing that needs to be said very clearly, you know, we don't have the pretense to tell countries what their, you know, their dynamics look like, right?
What they should be doing, for sure.
But even the data, right? I mean, we put out what we call estimates based on, you know, certain methodologies that are commonly accepted. At the end of the day, the countries are still kings and queens in, you know, putting out their national official view, right? The point is that many of the countries that we work with are not in a position to, you know, to develop data with this level of granularity of details, and that's why I'm saying, in terms of public goods, not just for the users at home, but also for countries that are not yet able to arrive at this level of details, they then can use them to set policies and hopefully efficient and good policies for the climate.
So it's they're not, you know, on their list of things to do. this kind of sophisticated data collection and analysis is not top of their list. You're providing this service for them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it may be top of, yes, sure. No, of course. I mean, data, as you know, is becoming to the fore of the attention of everyone. It's just difficult to produce them consistently and comparably over
right,
time.
Right. So that's I'm like, not in the U.S. No, I'm just kidding.
Not in the U.S.
Yeah, we don't like facts here anymore. No. So final question. What is next? I mean, you just put out this like incredible report. This database is now available that represents an enormous amount of work. So I kind of hate to ask this, but I am curious. Mm-hmm. Like, what next? What are you going to be focusing on?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are several next steps. I mean, some of them are sort of maybe boring to the outside. I don't know. I mean, I'll let you judge for it. Part of the work for us, and especially from an FAO perspective now, because as you mentioned before, rightly, this is a collaboration between us and the JRC, where they had sort of the advantage on the post-production component, and we, of course, have the advantage on the farm plus land use. So we're trying to develop a stronger collaboration so that we can keep up this product over time. And, from an FAO perspective, of course, we're also trying to move the machinery within FAO so that we can serve our countries sort of independently, whenever they ask us. So mm-hmm. right now, as we always do with databases, the first part is to have it sustainable over time. And we have a version now that arrives to 2018 already. With that goal of then keeping it updated every year, right? To provide not just a knowledge base, but also some sort of, quote unquote, because the word is very politically charged, but it's a monitoring platform of seeing how things evolve around the world. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what we do next often depends on what countries ask us to do in terms of interest. But one of the things we're interested in is maybe go a bit deeper into this, per capita dynamics that you mentioned before, to try to understand a bit better the breakup between the various components between agricultural land and post-production. Mm-hmm. And make sure that the data keep on flowing over time. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Congratulations on, getting this out there. And I can't wait to have you back with the updated information as that comes out.
Okay. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support. Show intern is Amber Chong. Our engineer is Matt Patterson. And music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or wherever podcasts are found. I'm Jenna Liut, and thanks.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
For listening.